Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem Bühnenpodcast für die Dame, die so gern daran glauben würde, dass ein Lied eine Brücke sein kann. Heute zu Gast Dean Vuletic, Historiker, der sich eingehend mit der Geschichte des Eurovision Song Contests auseinandergesetzt hat, der ja dieses Jahr im Mai in Wien stattfinden wird. Es wird dann auch einige Etablissement-Episoden und Berichte aus Wien geben über diesen Wettbewerb, der ja nicht nur ikonisch ist, sondern auch immer wieder umstritten. Wen also besser fragen als Dean Vuletic, der auch Professor Song Contest genannt wird. Seine Kommentare, Interviews und Artikel sind auf ABC, BBC, in der New York Times, wo auch immer zu lesen, zu sehen, zu hören. Und jetzt ist er im Etablissement. Wir reden über die Geschichte des Contests, die Politik oder Nicht-Politik, die queere Liebe zum Eurovision Song Contest, aber auch, wie soll es in diesen Zeiten anders sein, über die Teilnahme Israels. Mir waren einige Dinge, die er erzählt, so nicht klar und ich hoffe, ihr findet die Episode auch erhellend. Hier ist Dean Vuletic. First of all, I wanted to ask you, you wrote this book about, like, it's called Postwar Europe and the Eurovision Song Contest, for which you, as I understand it, researched deeply, deeply into the history of the contest. Can you tell me a little about the history? And with a little, I mean a lot, of course.
I can certainly tell you a lot about the history of Eurovision. I watched every single edition of Eurovision. I analyzed every song, the biographies of all of the artists. And I went into the archives of the Eurovision Song Contest in Geneva. So all the documents that the European Broadcasting Union holds on the Eurovision Song Contest, I read those as well. So I was the first historian to go in and really deeply study those archives. And I've been to a lot of archives across Europe, broadcasting archives, television archives. So my research into Eurovision was certainly very intense. And what can I tell you about the history of Eurovision, let's say, in a few sentences?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Eurovision has always reflected politics in Europe. It has always reflected the political zeitgeist. It has always been a barometer for politics, even though the contest is itself conceived as a non-political event. And this is why a lot of people laugh when they say, oh, the European Broadcasting Union still presents Eurovision as non-political. Ha, ha, ha. But no, it actually is non-political. It doesn't have a political agenda because the European Broadcasting Union is an association of national public service broadcasters. It's a technical association, not a political association. But nonetheless, we have entries being submitted by these broadcasters which represent countries. Countries are then competing in Eurovision. And whenever countries compete, politics is bound to get involved. So this is why we also like to read Eurovision as a show of international relations that tells us something about the politics of the times.
When was the Eurovision founded and why?
It was founded in 1956, and it was founded essentially as a technical experiment to see if broadcasters from several Western European states could broadcast at the same time live across their countries the same television show. Because this was a time when television technology was emerging in these countries, and when one of the goals of the European Broadcasting Union was to develop this television technology. Because also at the time, not everyone wanted TV. You know, in some countries, it was considered too expensive, too much of a luxury. People wondered what its social effects were, much as people wonder today what the effects of social media are on us. And there was also this idea in some countries, I mean, Israel, for example, that radio was enough. You know, we don't need this luxury of television. It's too much. We have radio. That's enough, you know, to communicate, to build nations and so on. So through the European Broadcasting Union, different broadcasters from across Europe could cooperate. And one of the ways they did this was by producing programs which they broadcast live at the same time, with the Eurovision Song Contest being one of the best examples of that and one of the examples that has persisted.
How many members were there in the beginning, like when the whole thing was founded?
So in Eurovision, there were seven members in 1956. So the Benelux countries, France, West Germany, Switzerland, and Italy.
That's so interesting. I had no idea that it was a technical experiment. I
yeah,
always thought
people.
There must be some kind of European big idea behind it.
Not at all. A lot of people get this wrong. They think that Eurovision was a European project or created as a project of European integration because it emerged at a time when the foundational organizations of what we know today as the European Union were emerging. And but the European Broadcasting Union has always been separate from the European Union. Like I said, it has never had a political agenda, political standards for membership, which has meant that it has always also included more countries than the European Union has. And so when commentators say, well, Eurovision started as a project of European unity or European integration, my first answer to that is, well, the host was Switzerland, Lugano, 1956 is where the first Eurovision was held. And Switzerland has never entered the European Union. It's also always been very Eurosceptic. So actually, when you look at it from that perspective, then you also better understand the work of the European Broadcasting Union and why it is not political.
Are there moments that stood out for you, like in the history of the contest, like where you think like this is worth mentioning, or that was very important, like very important steps to where we are now?
This is the work of a historian, to look at turning points, to find the turning points, and to also identify, you know, the key moments, the moments that really change things. And the moments that also leave a legacy. So I would say that, you know, after the first one in 1956, I would say the next big year is 1961, when we see national broadcasters from countries that aren't liberal democracies enter Eurovision. So Yugoslavia, Spain, and Portugal. Yugoslavia was a communist state at the time. Spain and Portugal were right-wing dictatorships. And, you know, this is also another story of Eurovision, how dictatorships and authoritarian regimes have throughout the history of the contest used it to whitewash their international images. The next turning point comes in 1974 for so many reasons. First of all, it's ABBA.
Historic, yes.
Eurovision's biggest hit ever is launched, Waterloo. But you also have a lot of politics going on. You have the Portuguese entry, which will soon be used to start a revolution, to signal the start of a revolution in Portugal, a revolution against the right-wing dictatorship. You have Greece debut, and it's debuting under a military junta. Yugoslavia send an entry which, for the first time, has these political tropes that are being promoted by the Communist Party at a time in Yugoslavia when liberal leaders in the country have been purged. Then you also have the Italian entry, which is censored in Italy because it's called Si, meaning yes, and it's coming at a time when there is going to be a referendum on divorce in Italy. And you also have the Dutch entry, which is the first entry that refers to drugs in Eurovision. And this is at a time when the Dutch are talking about the decriminalization of the use of some drugs. So in 1974, you just have so much going on. It's not just about ABBA. Then I would say the next big turning point is 1989-1990, the end of the Cold War. Yugoslavia wins in 1989. The Cold War ends, and in 1990, the contest is staged in Zagreb. And there are so many songs talking about European unity and the hopes that have come with the end of the Cold War, but it's being staged in Zagreb, and we know what's going to happen to Yugoslavia, that Yugoslavia is soon about to disintegrate and disintegrate into war. Then we have the first decade of the 2000s, when a lot of Central and East European countries win for the first time. And we see the contest being hosted in Ukraine, Serbia, Russia, at a time of political transformation in these countries. And then in Azerbaijan in 2012. 2014 is a big year because it's when Conchita Wurst wins. And in my book, my book has just come out in a second edition with a new chapter that includes the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And 2014 is a huge year because it's when Eurovision starts to get embroiled in global culture wars following the win of Conchita Wurst. 2020, the first time Eurovision is cancelled because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then I would say the next big turning point is 2023 in Malmö, when the biggest street demonstrations ever against the contest take place in a host city. And in this case, it's because of Israel's participation. And this results also in a lot of the rules of the contest being changed, or new rules being brought in to manage the politicization of the contest. Not only because of the street protests, but also because of the interference of some governments in the contest and, let's say, their involvement in campaigns to garner votes for their entries, most obviously, you know, the Israeli.
Yeah. What do you make of the Israeli participation? Because everybody is talking about it at the moment. Why is Israel in the competition? And maybe you can explain this.
Israel debuted in Eurovision in 1973. And the reason why it is in Eurovision is a technical reason, because it is part of a region called the European Broadcasting Area. Now, this is an area that was delineated in the interwar period, at a time when the predecessor of the European Broadcasting Union was formed and being expanded. Basically, this European Broadcasting Area was delineated in order to arrange cooperation among European states in broadcasting, because this was a time when the newest technology was radio. And the different countries of Europe needed to cooperate in order to manage the development of this technology, to organize radio frequencies so that they wouldn't interfere with each other and so on. And in the end, what they did was they defined the region by 30 degrees latitude north to include the top of North Africa, because, of course, you know, North Africa is very close to Southern Europe, and so you needed cooperation there when it came to radio frequencies. And they decided to put the eastern limit at 40 degrees east to reach all the way to Moscow, so as to include the Soviet Union. But you see that when these two lines meet, that means that also the eastern Mediterranean is included, the countries of the Levant, at that time, Jordan, Syria, Palestine. This means that when Israel becomes a state in 1948, that Israel is also part of the European Broadcasting Area. And as the European Broadcasting Union takes this area as the definition for its membership, Israel is also eligible to become a member of the European Broadcasting Union and to participate in Eurovision, like many North African and Middle Eastern states are. It's amazing how people don't know facts or don't want to read up on facts, because I've explained all of this in my book, but still I get the same questions all the time. Oh, did this start out as a peace project? Did this start out as an integration project? Oh, why is Israel in Eurovision? Is it because of Holocaust guilt or something like that? It's, you know, the facts are all there. It's just that people, in this day when we have so much information available, it's amazing how the facts still do not get to people. You know, people are consuming information in different ways. And when they see a history book with a lot of details, you know, perhaps that's not the easiest way for them to get information.
Yeah.
But you know, we have to believe in science. We have to believe in research, and understand that, you know, that is where true knowledge comes from. It's not some, you know, some gossip.
Can you maybe explain to me again, like how it happens that Eurovision claims itself to being non-political, but also it is political? Why is it not political?
So the European Broadcasting Union is a non-political organization. It's a technical association which come together, you know, to advance cooperation in broadcasting, in the media. So when it comes to Eurovision, Eurovision is also conceived as a joint television production, as a platform to promote popular music, the cultural production of different countries in Europe. So it doesn't have a political agenda. You don't see in the Eurovision rules that they're trying to promote some sort of politics, political messages, political standards. No, this is just a television production. And when you speak to the people in charge of Eurovision, you understand they're television professionals. Their main aim is to put on a great show, to impress, wow viewers, as they manage to do every year. So still, you know, this is the main motivation behind Eurovision, to put on this television show that is staged or shown live across many different countries, and even these days across the world, because it's broadcast on the internet. So that's the main aim. The aim is not to somehow solve international politics or have Eurovision as a platform for politics. But, you know, it has become that because there are a lot of different actors in Eurovision besides the EBU, which have tried to use the contest to promote political causes, to send political messages.
It's so interesting to me because usually in, you know, if you look from an art standpoint on entertainment stuff, you always would think, oh, it's not real art is political. But sometimes I feel like it's exactly the other way around. Like, because so many people love something like Eurovision, it's inherently also, as an historian, interesting to look at it because there's all the politics is there. It says so much about the current state of the world. So also, if you look at it today, and probably there will be like a lot of protests again in Vienna. I don't know this year.
There will be protests. I'm sure there will be protests. But I mean, it's normal to have protests. When we had the Olympic Games in Paris, there were protests. There will be protests at this year's World Cup, I'm sure. Mega events always attract protests because mega events attract a lot of attention. And so the organizers of these protests use the mega events to draw attention to their own causes. This is normal. And this is something that we should be proud of. We live in liberal democracies where protests are allowed. So even the European Broadcasting Union has said, I remember when the protest was staged in Malmo, the European Broadcasting Union said, of course, you know, the protest should be allowed. You know, we have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. Sweden is a liberal democracy. So I don't think the protests are anything to be fearful of. I think, you know, this is a normal part of democracy that we should understand and appreciate.
There's also something I wrote. It's the Intervision Song Contest. What was that? I also a thing I never heard about. That was super fascinating to me.
The Intervision Song Contest is also something that I've researched in depth. I had a research project at the University of Vienna. And basically, during the Cold War, it was staged in Czechoslovakia and Poland in the 1960s and in the 1970s up until 1980. And in both cases, it was used by these countries to promote cooperation between East and West and to show that these countries were open to cultural exchange, open to Western cultural influences, despite the fact that they were part of the Soviet-controlled Eastern Bloc. So let's say they were used by these countries to promote images of them at a time when these countries were experiencing periods of political liberalization. However, in recent years, Russia has sought to revive Intervision as the Russians say, revive Intervision, which they succeeded in doing in 2008 and last year in 2025. They say that they've revived Intervision, but it's actually a myth. The Russians, the Soviets never led Intervision during the Cold War. And during the Cold War, like I said, Intervision was presented as an event that could bring Eastern and Western artists together. Whereas last year's Intervision, for example, was definitely a challenge to Eurovision. It was presented as an event promoting traditional and family values, you know, in stark contrast to Eurovision, which is portrayed by Russian politicians and the media as this liberal, decadent event, especially because it's promoting the visibility of sexual minorities. So, yes, Intervision last year was not the Intervision of the Cold War era. It was actually a less, I would say, less open, less progressive.
I see. Is it as campy as Eurovision, if I have to imagine it, or even more campy? Because it's a big appeal of the Eurovision Song Contest, I think, is also like this camp.
Yeah, but I think camp is in the eye of the beholder. Would we want to view an event like Putin's Intervision as camp? Actually, I don't think so, because, you know, camp in itself implies some sort of political or social criticism.
Yeah.
And in Intervision, you didn't see that. It sort of took itself too seriously. You know, it had messages from Putin. It had an interview with Sergei Lavrov in it. So it was maybe too. It was too serious to be campy, and certainly too controlled, I would say.
Where do you think the queer love for Eurovision comes from? Or why do a lot of queer people, it means a lot to a lot of queer people like Eurovision. Why is that?
I think queer people love Eurovision and, you know, have historically been one of its biggest fan bases because they tend to relate to the artists and to the lyrics of the songs more than other people might. So when they see the solo singer on stage, standing there alone in front of the whole world, being watched by the whole world, exposing themselves to the whole world, it's a bit like queer people might feel sometimes that, you know, they're different, they're drawing attention. You know, this exposure and visibility, which, you know, was not always visibility in European societies, but which, you know, made them feel somehow different from the rest and separate from the rest of society. So I think, you know, this is one of the reasons associating with this figure on stage. Then you look at the biographies of a lot of the artists. You know, a lot of them have also had rather challenging biographies in terms of their identities. Then you look at the songs, which, you know, talk about the challenges of life, the challenges of love, personal empowerment, all of these issues that are important to all of us, but which queer people might relate to in a certain way. Then there's the aesthetics. Then there's the aesthetics of the contest.
Yes, I just wanted to ask you.
But which have always been very close to gay culture, you know, drag culture, the culture of divas. These are all elements that have also been very important for gay culture. So I think that on a lot of different levels, I often find it very difficult to articulate why, because when I think, for example, about this association with the solo artist on stage being exposed to the world, it's hard for me to exactly explain that sentiment or that solidarity that a queer person might feel with that person who is not only exposing themselves to the whole world, but putting themselves under scrutiny from the whole world. And I think this is also another thing, that these artists are being, you know, scrutinized, you know, how they look, how they sing, their costumes and so on, that it might also be you know, dealing with criticism, with this excessive scrutiny is something that queer people might also empathize with.
Yeah. Do you have favorite Eurovision moments, like show-wise, song-wise, where you think like,
definitely.
Oh, this... Yeah, yeah. Which are those?
So let's say in recent years, no, actually, let's go back to my first live Eurovision in Jerusalem in 1999. I remember that was a fantastic contest, you know, the last one of the second millennium. And Doris Dragovic sang for Croatia, and it was the song Maria Magdalena, which was a great dance song. And I remember afterwards hearing it in a club in Jerusalem and everyone just going crazy, dancing to that song. For me, my family's Croatian. So, you know, that was Croatia's biggest achievement until then. And people thought it would win, but it didn't win. But I remember that moment, you know, very well, especially in the club. And then I would say one of my most fun songs is Occidentalis Karma from Italy, from Francesco Gabani. And I tend to like the Italian songs.
Okay, yeah.
That's one that you could really dance to. It was, you know, fun, but it also had some serious messages behind it. And then 2018... my most emotional song, I think, is the song from Germany, Michael Schulte, You Let Me Walk Alone. And it's about him losing his father. And it did so well. It was one of Germany's biggest successes. It didn't win, unfortunately. But it's such a touching song. And I think for anyone who's lost a parent, you know, it's a song that is so easy to relate to. And it's really the first Eurovision song that, and I think the only one that made me cry. So I think that is also one of the,
I think he went to fourth place or something.
Yeah, was he, it went, fourth he place? Came fourth. He was fantastic. He was absolutely fantastic. And then when German people say to me, we'll never win Eurovision, Europe doesn't like us, or we never send a good song, I always say, Michael Schulte, 2018, he had one of the most beautiful songs ever, in my mind, in the history of the contest. And I've watched every Eurovision song. And I can tell you that's the only one that made me cry.
Where did you watch it? By the way, just last question. Where did you watch all the Eurovisions? Could you download them somewhere? Or is there an archive where you could go to and they you sat there and watched 100 years of television?
By the time I was doing my research, so in 2013, I started my research project at the University of Vienna on the history of Eurovision. I had a grant from the Marie Skłodowska-Curie Actions of the European Commission. So it's a big European research grant. And then I started researching in 2013. And by then, you could find all of the recordings on YouTube.
Ah, okay.
They weren't official from the European Broadcasting Union. They were just from fans who had posted on YouTube. So the internet changed a lot for Eurovision, not only for historical research, but in how it has made Eurovision accessible to people all over the world. So that's how I watched every song.
How did you grow up with Eurovision, or how did you first came into contact with Eurovision yourself?
I was born in Australia. I grew up in Australia, and I started watching Eurovision in Australia in the 1980s because it was broadcast on one of our television stations, the Special Broadcasting Service, or SBS, as it's called. And SBS is also the broadcaster behind Australia's entries now. And we were able to watch Eurovision on SBS in Australia in the 1980s. And that's how my love for the contest grew. So by the time I went to university at the Australian National University, I was studying European politics and languages. And with my friends from university, we would put on parties for Eurovision, hire out one of these cultural clubs in Canberra, because, you know, in Australia, different ethnic national groups have their clubs. So, like, you know, you would have a German club, a French club, Italian club, Croatian club, Polish, and you know, they have, I don't know, sometimes a restaurant, a bar, and this space inside where they have cultural events. So we would get one of those and stage Eurovision parties. And then I went to Eurovision in 1999 for the first time when I was studying abroad in Israel. So that's how I really came to love Eurovision. After that, I began to pursue it more academically. For my PhD, I wrote about popular music and politics in Eastern Europe, and I spoke a lot about Yugoslavia and why it was the only Eastern European country in Eurovision during the Cold War. And that's also when I went to the European Broadcasting Union to do research in archives. And then I realized, look, now I have to just write on the history of Eurovision, write a book. And I got my research project in Vienna and yeah, wrote the book. And I'm also commenting a lot on Eurovision in the media.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that people are like ringing you up all the time at the moment. It's like, what? Israel,
Definitely. Israel is a big topic, has been a big topic now for a few years. Understandably, but also I think it's a shame that people aren't asking about other issues as well, because then you see other political issues disappear from the radar. Like last year, if you remember the song from Georgia, Freedom, it was a very patriotic song, and it also had a political meaning at a time when Georgia had basically put on pause its negotiations for membership of the European Union, and its government had taken more of a turn towards Russia. So, having a patriotic song called Freedom appearing on the Eurovision stage in that context certainly had a political meaning. But journalists didn't ask me about that. They were always asking me about Israel and the protests concerning Israel's participation. That was also the case the year before in 2023 in Malmo. So there is a lot going on politically every year, but usually it's only a few issues that really capture the attention of the media.